and Human Services Subcommittee on Child Welfare to order this Monday, April 25th, 2005. For the audience, we have 5 bills up in the area of child welfare, and what the chair is intending to do this week is to continue to collect information on these specific bills as we wade through the various concepts that people are advancing in the area of promoting child welfare protections. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to open up a public hearing on all these bills, and you are free as the members of the public to testify on any of these bills that are up today. And so I encourage you, if you have some public comment to share with us, that you let us know what those comments are. My intention is to get as much comment on the record of this subcommittee as we can, so that everybody on the subcommittee can hear the same information, and that we could all work together on a resolution to some of these legislative initiatives. I don't want to have personal conversations on these measures with folks, and so if some of you have approached me to ask me about these bills and my response has been tell me in front of the committee, don't take that personally. It's just that I think it's more important to have all these issues out in the open so that we can discuss them as a matter of public business. So with that, I encourage you, if you haven't already done so, to sign up on one of those sign-up sheets, and we'll get you up to testify. So with that, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2009, open a public hearing on House Bill 2010, open a public hearing on House Bill 2334, open a public hearing on House Bill 2336, and open a public hearing on House Bill 2387. And I would invite Representative Jerry Crummell from Wilsonville up with his guests, who have traveled quite a ways to be here today. So, good afternoon and welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Crummell, can I just stop you for a second? Everybody who will be testifying, I'll need you to introduce yourself for the record. And since we've opened up all these bills simultaneously, I'll need you to just let us know what bill or bills you're speaking to. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Jerry Crummell, House District 26, which includes Wilsonville, Sherwood, and over to Gaston. Mr. Chair, I have introduced House Bills 2334 and 2336 because of a situation that came to my attention during the course of the interim, and over the course of about the last little over a year now. I have worked on these particular issues with the folks that are to my right, Mr. and Mrs. Stotts from Klamath Falls, and I've also worked with the department on these issues as well, and I'll let the Stotts give you a little bit of a briefing as far as what sorts of things that they face. But one of the things that we came to realize is that, and I recognize too, the department is also internally making some changes as well. Some of those changes were changes that I had suggested to them last summer. But one of the things that came to mind is that there is, and I, well, let me back up for just a second again. I recognize that this is for child welfare, but you know, one of the things that we have to realize is that there's also an issue of family welfare. And occasionally, when charges are made and they're baseless, the family as a whole really is affected and really can really suffer. And one of the things that we realized in the Stotts case is that the family as a whole and as a unit was kind of becoming victims of the system. And I think that we need to do whatever we can to prevent that from happening. So while I'm concerned about child welfare and I'm concerned about making sure that children are not placed in harm's way, and that if they are in harm's way, that they are able to be removed from that potential harm, there's also the other side of the coin, and that is when parents and other family members are affected in a negative way. So House Bills 2334 and 2336 are intended to address these particular issues. And one of the things that we came to realize with the Stotts is that there may have been some folks that were familiar with the family and knew both their elder daughter and the family as a whole through other meetings. And I think this is one of the things that we face sometimes in a small community. And so that is why House Bill 2334 was drafted, because basically what it would do is prohibit Child Protective Services caseworkers from being able to participate in the case if the employee is acquainted with an alleged abuse victim or the family. And I would also like to introduce to you the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2334, which I believe you have copies, or at least I hope. I know we provided it to the staff. And this amendment was drafted at the after visiting a little bit more with the department. And it gives the department the ability to extend if the department becomes aware that an employee has participated in an investigation or assessment or enforcement that they shouldn't have, then it gives the department the ability to have caseworkers from another county come in and sort of look at that, and then for the department to take action. 2336 is a bill that was drafted because one of the things that we found in the Stotts case was that the was that the case seemed to drag on. Number one, the Stotts were never advised of any of their of any due process rights that they might have or should have. And the second thing was that there was concern about the length of time that it took for this case to move through the system, and it seemed like there were a lot of barricades that got put up. So basically what 2336 does is that it requires the Department of Human Services to complete its investigations within 30 days after commencing the investigation. Again, after visiting with the department a little bit, we realized that sometimes that's just not possible to complete an investigation, especially if it's been a if it's a real complicated case, or you have complicated players in the case, that 30 days just may not be enough time. So what we've done is we've drafted the Dash 3 amendments, and I know where the Dash 1s are because I had those drafted. I do not know where the Dash 2s are and who might be responsible for those. But the Dash 3 amendments were drafted to give the department a little bit of leeway so that if they can't complete their investigation within 30 days, that they can give an extension to the amount of time so that the investigation can move forward. However, it also requires the department or allows the department to adopt rules, but the rules have to be fairly narrow in terms of the criteria as to what would constitute extreme, special, or unusual circumstances and then the ability to grant the extension. But that way it does give the department some flexibility, and I did, again, as I mentioned, work with the department on that. Now, what I would like to do is stop there, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to turn it over to Mr. and Mrs. Stotts, let them kind of give the committee a real briefing of what sort of they went through and why these bills are they feel that these bills are important, and then for family welfare, and then be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, but before we do that, Representative, this is an informal committee that I say that just because I like to ask questions while we're working through things.
Sure.
So we can get as much information as possible. So I just wanted to stop you and ask you a question.
By all means.
And this is, again, this is different than the way we do other committees, just for this subcommittee, because we're really trying to get at some key questions. I just wanted to know, is it your opinion, is it your sense, Representative Crummell, that that what you're proposing in House Bill 2334, that you would that this bill would prohibit you know, these child protective workers from working in an environment where they knew the family. Is that realistic? Is that practical? Can they do that in some of these smaller communities? Have you researched that?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, for the question. You know, in some of the smaller communities, it's going to be a little bit more difficult. But given that, quite frankly, if I had my way, for example, a person that has grown up in Klamath Falls would be prohibited from working in Klamath Falls if they were working for DHS as a caseworker. They'd have to be moved to somewhere else in the state. That's my own personal opinion. I don't know. Well, of course, we can legislate that. Now, whether or not a majority of the House members and a majority of the Senate members and the governor would be willing to go along with that or not, I don't know. I know there would probably be some pushback from the department on that. There's also
clarify what you said. So you're saying if somebody grew up in one community, that they shouldn't be doing that kind of work in that community, is it?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. Because, you know, it's kind of like, well, I knew you in high school and I knew you when, and, you know, I mean, there's a lot of old baggage that too many times can come into play. I can tell you from my own personal experience years ago, and this was not me working as a caseworker, but my sister, when she was hired by the Department of Human Services in Washington as a welfare caseworker, they would not send her back to Walla Walla because that's where she grew up, and they actually sent her then to the Yakima area.
Okay. So, Representative Greenlake?
Yeah, I you and I had some conversations with definitions. Again, I'm going to have another one. If you have a caseworker, and a caseworker is working on the case, doesn't know the case outside, but is very familiar with the case, has been involved with investigating a set of allegations, and now an allegation comes in, it seemed to me under your definition is acquainted with the alleged abuse victim, that caseworker would be excluded from continuing to work on that case because they are acquainted with the alleged victim. Is that your intention?
Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlake, the acquaintance that this bill is relating to is no. If it's been there's been a professional relationship, family's been on been under some kind of caseworker care, and now a new allegation comes in, I would not no. That caseworker would not necessarily be kept from participating in that investigation. What I'm relating to here is that you got a situation where maybe a family member of the caseworker worked with another family member of the alleged abuse victim or family in another arena, and now is able to have an impact or an influence on how that caseworker views that case, and that caseworker should not be investigating that particular case.
May I follow? So we obviously need to do something with that acquainted thing. The other thing is I know there are some, in many communities, some complex family relationships, and I wonder how, you know, if I've got a third cousin once removed who went to school with that person, I don't have any real relationship with that. How am I going to figure out if any of my family members through blood or marriage or adoption had an acquaintance with them? I mean, it seems to me that's a pretty high standard.
In fact,
in order to find that out, I might have to break confidentiality. I might have to go around. I get an abuse case, I'm going to have to now start asking my cousins, you know this person? Do you know that person? Did you go to school with this other person?
I think generally, and again, you find this more often in smaller communities than in a larger community such as Salem or Portland areas. But I think generally people are going to know if they've got family members that are acquainted with the abuse victim or with the abused victim's family.
Okay. Let's hear from the Stotts.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mitch.
My name is Keith Stotts. I happen to be from Klamath Falls and experienced a situation with the Department of Human Services last year. what it's regarding is an adult daughter of mine from a previous marriage that was injured in a car accident and is now quadriplegic in a wheelchair. Started in actually January. We passed out a timeline frame for you to give you the, but I don't want to take your time to go over all of it so you can read it. But there are some dates from when it started in January all the way through November when I was able to go back home and live with my family. A couple of things I'd like to bring to one of the things that's on the top of my mind when you're asking Mr. Crummell here regarding the if the caseworkers can work in the with each case. My opinion on that there is an immediate family member. If there's an immediate family member working, that's what we experience. We experience immediate family members working with the case, like a mother-daughter situation, and I feel that's a conflict, especially in a situation that Shannon was in. I mean, she's a 19-year-old girl in a wheelchair. That's a tragedy. You know, that's terrible for anybody to have to go through life like that. So people have a tendency, I think, to look at them and go, boy, that's, you know, they feel sorry for them. And in our situation, it linked a DHS worker and her mother had worked at the school with her personally. And that was, I felt that there needs to be some changes made there. As well as there was other immediate DHS workers that worked on our case that roomed with another DHS worker that was married to a very good friend of mine at one time. So I think that there's, you know, some conflicts there that needs to be addressed. I don't really know how much you want me to go into this. I know that in April I was taken out of my home by DHS, and basically I terminology use that it is I was a gun was held to my head, basically, not physically, but they said you either go along with this safe plan or we're going to take your two minor children away from you and your wife, period. Of course, what did we do? We went with the safe plan. We signed it and went on. At that time, I was removed from the home. They said it'd be a couple of weeks. Obviously, it was 7 months, just about to the day. In that time, we went through a lot of supervised visitation that we had to pay for ourselves. In the meantime, we hired attorneys. Some of the things that I think that I want to bring up to the committee here is that not everybody's able to pay for supervised visitors. The state was giving us 1 hour a week for one day of a week to see my kids. This whole deal traumatized these two young children. I mean, totally traumatized them to the point that they were having accidents, acting out, and we have very, very, very good kids. They're really good kids. And so it had really taken its toll on these two young children. And we got them into counseling for a lot of reasons for their own good, but also the state was basically trying to make me out to be a monster, and I wanted the counselor to be able to evaluate it. If I'm what the state's saying I am, it's going to come out in the professionals' evaluations, you know, and as well get my children help. And so we went through all of that. Of course, that was an expense out of our pocket again. Not everybody's going to be able to do that. Your average person isn't. They can't afford that. You take a person that's making $9, $10 an hour, are they going to be able to pay people for supervised visits? The supervised visitors that we were paying were making $20, $25 an hour. You can't do that. I mean, the average person's not going to be able to. So I think that there is a number of different things involving stuff like that. The state had asked me for supervised visitor lists. We had given that to them. There happened to have been law enforcement people on there on that list. They wanted to know how we knew them people. We explained to them how we knew them and how long they had been in law enforcement. They said that they weren't qualified to be supervised visitors. The state said that these law enforcement people with 15 plus years law enforcement experience were not experienced to look for sexual abuse or whatever, but yet they're the people that go out in the homes and remove children from the homes and so on and so forth. Just things like that, I think, that are very peculiar that the state. And the other thing is that the state was using that using law enforcement, between law enforcement and the state, they were using it all against us. And when I say against us, I mean totally against us. We, our family became victims that day. There was never, out of all the investigation, there was never any proof of anything. We cooperated with the state on everything. We cooperated with law enforcement and everything. And you know, we have a situation that I think there's a lot of issues that need to be addressed.
Okay, so let's sort of focus this in. Because it sounds like there's a really difficult situation that your family is experiencing now that has risen to the level of intervention by the Department of Human Services. And so just trying to tie this together, what is it that you see that the Department of Human Services could have done differently in your circumstances? What specific recommendations are you offering? And how do those tie into the legislation that Representative Crummell is advancing?
First thing, letting us know all of our rights in a timely manner, and what we can do, and so on, and, you know, to try to get to, through this case and not drag it out for 7 months.
Okay, let me stop you there. So, nobody offered you or your family an indication of what rights you had when they brought you into a situation where you were going to sign some kind of safe.
Right. Absolutely. When we signed the safe plan, we were not told what our rights were and what we could do and what we couldn't do.
Okay, so let me step back then a little bit. So you're in your home, you're living life normally, and all of a sudden you get contacted by the Department of Human Services. Somebody knocks on your door and says, we have to talk about some issues. What's the process? And I don't want to go into long, and I don't want to go into details, but how did that work?
Basically what happened is Shannon had made an allegation against me.
Who's Shannon?
She's my adult daughter.
Your adult daughter that's the disabled
yep.
person. Okay.
She's the one that's making the allegation against me.
Okay.
And she was at school, a senior in high school. She made the allegation to a counselor at school. Law enforcement was notified. She said the allegation happened in the home while my minor children, two minor children were there. And so law enforcement had contacted me as well as wanted to contact my wife to sit down and talk to us. There was two detectives and a state worker that met with us.
Okay, so an accusation was made. Law enforcement contacted you,
mm-hmm.
said, we have these accusations. We want to sit down with you and talk about them with a child welfare worker. Okay. So did anybody give you an indication of what your rights were at that time?
No.
Or what your options were?
No.
Unless rights, options, whatever.
No.
Okay. Okay. And so then after that, you had a conversation with law enforcement and the child welfare folks. And child welfare obviously processed your discussion, your conversations, came back to you with the safe plan.
It happened all right in an office. We were all sitting together. The safe
all
plan
at the
got
same time.
It got written up right there while we were sitting there, slid across the table in front of us, and said, you need to sign this.
Okay, so exactly what happened? This they said, look, we have some concerns. We have a plan. We think that this is the plan that's appropriate for your children. Sign this. Is that what happened?
Kathy Stutz, Chair. That when we were in this meeting, he explained what went on, what the allegations were, told us how serious it was. We agreed it was a serious thing. Went on to explain, you know, she's done this before. She was taken off her medication, which is a mood stabilizer. She was mad at us because she had to switch foster homes, which the state advised us to take her out of the one she was in because they had taken her off her medication. So when they came to us and said she had made these allegations stating that they had happened, some of them had happened in the home when the children were in the house, therefore our children were in threat to harm, and that we needed to sign the safe plan, and he would either have to move out or they were going to come take our children away from us. They didn't explain anything about a shelter hearing. We didn't find out about that until July. Now we're talking about from April to July that we even found out we even had a right to go to court and dispute any of this.
Okay. All right. So that, I think we've got that one covered now, letting people know their rights. So the, so what else? I said three things, right? Letting people know their rights.
Yeah.
How it pertains to this bill. Well, I said three things. Letting people.
How it pertains to the bills.
Right. How, and how does it? Oh, right. Right. Which bill does it? Yeah.
That particular would be the actual of House Bill 2336 would be under what we just discussed about the 30 days, getting it done in a timely manner, showing us what our options were, going through the process. Again, it, another point for them is that they didn't tell us they wanted any, like the psychosexual assessments done until October. Again, how many months later from April to October to tell us what they wanted, what they needed done in order to make a difference at that time.
Let me bring one thing up. When this young lady got in this accident, I spent 2 months in North Dakota with her, and it traumatized the two younger children.
This being, young lady being your daughter?
Yes.
Your biological daughter?
Biological daughter from previous marriage. She was in a car accident in North Dakota and was in a trauma unit in North Dakota. I spent 2 months back there with her, overseeing her medical care and stuff. It traumatized the two younger children then. I had just came back and got into the home, back in the home for about a, pretty close to a year. After, you know, of course, we brought this girl into our home, too, after running her through rehab and stuff like that. And there was a lot of issues involved and a lot of struggles with going through all this with the two minor children and stuff. And then the state steps in, and in all honesty, they acted like they wanted to be a hero. And this is what came about.
Okay, all right. So I'm reading House Bill 2336, and it says, in all cases of alleged child sexual abuse as described in ORS 419B 005, Section 1, Sub A, Sub C, D, and E, by parent, the department shall complete its investigation no later than 30 days after receiving a report of abuse, et cetera, et cetera. So how long did it take for the department, in your circumstance, to complete their investigation?
To complete their investigation?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they ever did complete their investigation.
Okay, how long did it take for them to do the bulk of the work that was required?
I can't answer that either, because they never actually... The state really didn't do any investigation. They worked with law enforcement, and every time you'd ask them what was going on, they'd say it's under investigation through law enforcement. I mean, like I say, they continued to work back and forth. You know, Department of Human Services, law enforcement was the Department of Human Services. It was together. For me to be able to go back home, it was in October 22nd. Is when one of my attorneys had been in contact with the AG's office and said that we had had a jurisdictional hearing scheduled for the 28th and 29th October. They said all they wanted was a psychosexual evaluation. We had then performed all of that, got it in writing to them in November. They lifted their jurisdiction restrictions, and I went home on the 18th of November.
So you left when?
The 13th of April.
And then you got home 18th of November.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Representative Crummell, maybe you can help me out here. So what are we trying to accomplish in this 30 days? What are you hearing that indicates that these investigations are taking longer than 30 days?
Well, this is the primary case that I've been intimately involved with. Although since I started working on this particular case, then I was advised that there were some cases up in Washington County. Senator Winters had called me about a couple of cases that she was familiar with in the Washington County area, and then there were some other. Assorted people that I had talked with that brought the issue up as well. And the thing that seemed to be very common there was that the department seems to drag their feet when they're getting into these investigations. If they're going to investigate these folks, and let's first of all let's let them know what their remedies are, what their rights are, what their due process rights are. And I know that the department, at my suggestion, is working on that. They've been working on that since last summer, making sure that they're handing out information to alleged victims' families or to people that are being charged. But I feel that it's important to move these things forward, because like in the Stotts case, you've got a situation where Mr. Stotts is being withheld from the family unless it's a supervised visitation. And I understand that trying to keep the children safe, and that's absolutely imperative that we do that. But at the same time, we can't be dragging our feet to the point when you've got the children starting to act out and wet their pants and wet the bed and go through a lot of other things that they shouldn't have to go through, and they wouldn't be going through if their parent was in the home. We need to recognize that and realize, wait a minute, you know, we're creating victims here because of our own sluggishness and because of our own lack of action. So let's move these along, and if we determine that there is a case here that needs to move forward, then let's move it forward. But if we can't determine that for whatever the reasons are, then let's get the parent back together with their family. Let's get the family unit back together. That should be the goal of the department. Keeping people apart should not be the goal of the department.
Yes.
And I think Mrs. Foley, Ramona Foley, would admit that to you, that keeping families together should be the goal of the department as well.
As opposed to protecting the children?
Mr. Chair and Representative Green, like, absolutely not. But let's not drag these investigations out. And that has become the issue, is that when we allow these investigations to drag out, we create victims in other parts of the family.
Okay.
Just go ahead.
If the problem, it seems to me, is this. They are balancing. They have to balance the two things that you and I just talked about. Balance protecting the child with keeping families together. And you and I both agree those are both vital things to do. I was wondering, though, when you give them too narrow a time frame and say, all right, you have 30 days to make a decision, would you then make that decision, if they don't have had enough time to gather information and do things, to make the decision at that point to protect the child or to get a family back together?
Mr. Chair and Representative Greenleck, that's one of the reasons why we put the amendment, why I'm introducing the -3 amendment, is because in talking with the department, I recognize that there may be some extenuating circumstances. There's going to be cases where they, for one reason or another, or maybe it's a variety of reasons, they can't make that decision then, and they need a time extension.
So
I'm willing to give them that time extension. Let's have a process for them to go through to get that extension, instead of just sort of saying, well, you know what, we haven't finished yet, and so we're going to keep going. Well, we thought you'd be back in your home in a couple of weeks, but, well, it looks like it's going to be a couple of more weeks. And then pretty soon it's a couple of more weeks, and pretty soon it's a couple of more weeks. And in the meantime, the family's not getting any answers at all. And that's not fair to the family. It's not fair to the younger children. It's not fair to the parents.
Representing Greenleck. I think if you look in timeline, you'll see in there that within a week they were taking forensic evidence. They had taken out, the only reason he was taken out of our home at all wasn't based because the two smaller children had any allegations against him. It was the adult daughter saying that something happened in the home, and they just happened to be in the house at the same time. Now, if you look at the timeline, they had done their forensic stuff within a week and a half. They got their stuff, their forensic done out. It came back negative. There was no evidence showing that anything ever happened in the home. And that was the only reason he was taken out of the home. So in that 30-day period, if that was a law, you would see that in that 30 days, they could have came to the conclusion, did it happen in the home or not? Therefore, is it safe for him to go home or not?
Or been able to look at it and say, do we need an extension of, you know, 15 days or another 30 days, something realistic. 7 months, I'm sorry, that's not realistic. As a taxpayer in the state of Oregon, that's not realistic. The other thing is what being victims and me looking at it, the state had a safe plan. they put it into the wheels in motion, either got the children out of the home or got the alleged perpetrator out of the home. Then that was it. They had done their job. They stepped back and just let time go on. And that, and there's many more cases that that happens. And that's exactly what happened here, cut and dry.
One more question. Did anything come out of the indictment in October?
Yep.
Were the charges filed out of that indictment?
Okay. Well, I will say thanks very much and excuse this panel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, Julie McFarland. I will, how about I bring you up on these two bills, 2334 and 2336, since we're on them. Welcome. Good afternoon.
Thank you. My name is Julie McFarlane. I'm a supervising attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project. We represent children involved in juvenile cases, and I will be brief on submitting written testimony that covers our position on these bills. We have some concerns about House Bill 2334 as it's drafted. I think that in general, we have often been of the opinion that it would be a good idea for DHS caseworkers, not all of whom are actually licensed social workers, to be subject to standards of ethics that licensed social workers are subject to. But the provisions of 2334 don't actually get to that kind of broader issue of ethical standards for caseworkers. They're drafted too broadly. We believe that the concept may be impractical.
Can you bring the microphone a little closer? I'm having trouble hearing you.
The concept may be impractical in smaller communities where there may be only one or two workers to assess and investigate cases, and that disqualifying employees because they are acquainted with the child abuse victim would be inappropriate in a number of circumstances, including where the acquaintance is slight or the worker is acquainted with the victim because they have investigated or assessed a prior complaint of abuse or neglect. We oppose this bill as written, and would, if the committee is interested in something on the issue of caseworker ethics, we would direct you to the National Association of Social Workers Code of Ethics, which covers this and other issues.
Do you have some suggestions then, as you reviewed this bill, that would capture what Representative Crummell is trying to accomplish and do so in a way that you think will work better?
I quoted the language from the National Association of Social Workers that's in their ethical standard. It maybe is not the greatest language for a statute, but perhaps legislative counsel could use it as a starting point. It basically requires that social workers not condone or engage in any dual or multiple relationships with clients or former clients in which there is a risk of exploitation or of potential harm to the client. So,
okay, and we don't have that now in administrative rule of statute?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay. Okay. Anything else?
Do you want me to move on to 23 or 36?
Please.
Okay. We have some concerns as well about House Bill 2336. We think that a 30-day limit on completion of child sex abuse investigations is actually a very good goal, and it's pretty much what's already required by policy, and I attached a copy of that policy to my testimony. What the policy provides for, however, that this bill does not, is the ability to get exceptions and... So I think that that's an important thing, because sometimes there is evidence that's difficult to get, like DNA evidence or medical test results that you simply can't get in 30 days.
What if this bill had some sort of exceptions crafted into it?
I think if there were exceptions similar to those that are in the rule, that that would be fine. I want to say, however, listening to the Stotts testimony, that it became apparent to me that they may not be talking only about what is covered by the idea of investigation of these cases or the policy that I've attached, because it seems clear that their delay also included after the case got filed in juvenile court. And generally, the case being filed in juvenile court sort of tolls or ends the investigation. And when you go to juvenile court and you file a petition, one of the things that you're asking for in a juvenile court petition is that the court conduct its own investigation. So at that point, technically and legally, the CPS investigation has ended, although they may still be wrapping up some things, but it's legally ended, and now the juvenile court has begun its process of investigation. So listening to their testimony, I would say that this bill does not really fully address the concerns that they were raising.
Okay. Just out loud, it'd be nice if the department could give us some kind of chart that would reflect the various timelines in those investigations and give that to us so we can have a clear understanding of it. I know they're in the back listening, so. Okay. Anything else?
That's all I have on these.
All right. Questions? Okay. Thanks very much. Okay, that's all I have on House Bill 2336 and 2334. So, Representative Crummell, we're going to continue to take testimony and continue to work through this, but we'll move on to some other bills right now. So, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll just hang on for 1 second. Actually, can I ask the Department of Human Services to come forward to answer a specific question, Mickey and Ramon, please? Good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
I had a question about the issue of letting people know their rights in a proceeding where they're having some kind of family meeting with a law enforcement and Department of Human Services personnel. So my question is there a standard procedure that includes informing the family that Department of Human Services has contacted, informing them of all the steps, what exactly is going on, that this is a law enforcement DHS meeting, and that at the end of this meeting you'll be offered, either to go on your way or to have a safe plan or whatever the options are, and if you should have a safe plan offered and if you should contest or, have an adverse reaction to that sort of plan, that you would have these different options. Is there some sort of standardized procedure that says here is the universe that we're working on right now?
Chair Dalto and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ramona Foley, Assistant Director at the Department of Human Services, Children, Adults, and Families. The administrative rules do instruct workers on what to say when they go out to do an investigation or an assessment. In listening to the testimony, what I was a little surprised by is many of those investigations are done jointly with law enforcement, and I would have been more surprised to hear that both law enforcement and child welfare did not talk with the family about what this is about, what are the allegations that are being looked at. One of the things we are doing, and we've worked with Representative Crummell around this particular concept, is producing a document that will be something handed to any individual when we knock on the door, and that individual will then know in writing. It won't be left up to just how the worker interprets, because in this state, law enforcement or a child welfare worker may be taking a child into custody. So we want something handed to the individual saying, and here's how you challenge this, here's what you can do if you're not satisfied, here are your options if you do not agree that we have a safety plan, for example, where you have to leave the home or the children have to leave the home.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was getting at. So you were having a discussion, Representative Crummell suggested this.
He did.
And the department is looking at this and taking the suggestion seriously and is going to produce a document that's going to do this.
And Chair Dalto, we also are trying to produce that in multiple languages so that we don't have a language barrier by giving an individual a brochure that they can't understand what that brochure is telling them.
Okay, so how far along are you in that process?
Do we have, do you know, Mickey, if we have a draft of that?
Chair Adalto and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mickey Cerise. I'm Deputy Assistant Director for the Department of Human Services, Children, Adults, and Families. And we do have a brochure that we use right now, and it probably doesn't meet the standard that Representative Crummell would like it to meet, and we're working on that. The bilingual information that Ramona just mentioned, we're also trying to produce that in a video format to provide to families, as well as something in paper that would explain to them the process, the next steps, what they can expect. There are, in that, I think there are several things to consider that we're looking at, and one of those is that we often, most often, enter the family along with law enforcement, and law enforcement is evaluating the potential for a criminal charge at the same time that we're looking at a child safety assessment. So those are running parallel, and they don't often cross or get into each other's way, but we have to be respectful of each of the two processes.
Okay. Okay, thanks very much. Next, we'll go to House Bill 2009, and this is a bill that says it requires the Department of Human Services, when a child has been placed in the department's legal custody, to first consider the child's grandparents or other birth relatives as prospective adoptive parents before considering other prospective adoptive parents. And actually, Mickey, could we invite you back up for a moment? Can you just give us a thumbnail sketch of the process right now? I don't know if you're prepared.
The process for what? Excuse me, Chair Adalto.
That's all right. The process for considering placements, and in particular, this bill has to do with putting grandparents before considering other prospective adoptive parents. What's the sort of procedure now?
Chair Adalto, and again, members of the committee, my name is Mickey Stories with the Department of Human Services. Actually, I would, if you, with your permission, I'd like to invite Kathy Ledesma here, who is our department expert in the area of adoptions, and she has been following this bill, and I will stay here in case Kathy needs some support.
Thanks. We're pretty friendly up here, though. Huh?
Chair Dalto, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kathy Ledesma. I am the Adoptions Manager at the Oregon Department of Human Services, Children, Adults, and Families. We have an administrative rule that is entitled Working with Relatives Toward the Placement of Children. And that is a very lengthy administrative rule that we began crafting in 2007, first published that in 1997. And it became a final administrative rule in 1999. It's very prescriptive in contact, in instructions to staff to work with the parents to identify any available relatives. Any relatives, give us their names, addresses, all the contact information at the shelter hearing. So within 24 hours of the child coming into care, within 60 days, we are required by administrative rule to contact all of the available relatives and to ask them if they're interested in being a temporary or permanent resource for the child, should the child require that. There's a standard letter that goes out that's part of the administrative rule. Relatives have an opportunity to respond. When they respond and ask to be considered, often we'll hold a family decision meeting so that the family can prioritize who among maybe six or eight different family members who have an interest would be the most suitable or might be the best fit for the child. We then complete an assessment on the family, and often the first thing that is, an assessment includes is a criminal investigation and then a look at the child protective service history of that family. If we find that the relative who is interested and available does not meet, cannot meet the standards, we send them a letter telling them exactly why we are ruling them out. We call that a relative rule out letter. Those letters are very, very explicit. We could provide you with a history of the list of the kinds of reasons that we rule relatives out. If a family does pass that muster, we will put them through a home study process. Where we run into trouble is when the relative resource is located in a different part of the state or even out of state, and we are working on a return home plan. So the child needs to be in proximity to the parent so they're available for visits and other services in conjunction with the parent.
If they're adopted out.
No, this is all within the first 6 months of the time the child has come into care. So we're concurrently working two plans. We're working the return home plan, and we're working the what if that doesn't work out plan, and the most preferable alternative is adoption. So if the relative is in a different part of the state, and so the family's in Salem, the relative's in Klamath Falls, we need to have the child in proximity to the parent to do visits, to be working that return home plan. What's going on, however, during that time is that the child is developing an attachment with their foster parent, who's often a non-related foster parent. So, and at 6 months, that foster parent, under our administrative rules and their statute that relates to this, has a different status, so they also can be asked, they also can ask to be considered as the adoptive resource. So sometimes we get into a tangle, and fortunate are those children who have two resources, two families who really want to adopt them, a relative who may be in a different part of the state, or the foster parent who's been caring for them. Those are very difficult decisions. Whenever possible, we do place those children with relatives. Adoptions in the last 2 years, 36% of our adoptions were with relatives. Nationally, it runs about 23% in other states, so we're much higher than the national average in placing adoptive children for adoption with relatives.
Okay.
Yes.
Down a little trail.
Yes.
Can I take you down a slightly different trail? It's very similar. I have a constituent who's been calling me and I'm trying to get more information, and I'll get to you when I do, who has three kids as a foster parent with some special needs kids. And he and his wife would like to adopt the kids, but they're... And I think you would like to adopt the kid. But he's particularly worried about, since they have special needs, about how to make sure that he and his wife can get some kind of permanent status that will still not put him on the hook. They're a modest income family for health care and psychological and other needs of the kids. Is there some way to deal with this complexity that can work out? And do we need to take it offline, which I'd be happy to do?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, we're glad to talk with you about that offline. There are several options. Our adoption plan is always guided by the best interest of the child, and we do believe that adoption is most often the best permanency plan for the child. For the child to have a permanent family with whom they share a name and other rights that go along with that. That's not always possible to happen. That's one of the reasons that we have adoption assistance that we can talk more with you offline about, is to support those kinds of families who are fostering special needs children and cannot really foresee how they would be able to support those children in an adoptive situation. There's financial assistance that's provided to support those kinds of adoptions, as well as Medicaid.
If there was an assertion that there's a different arrangements available, and this is why it's relevant to this bill, for relatives that go through either that adoption or that permanency process than for non-relatives, is that correct in terms of the resources available?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, it's a little more complex than a real simple answer.
Right.
If the relative has been the foster parent, has been caring for the child, the child's eligibility for adoption assistance is based on the circumstances at the time of the child's removal from home. So it's the child's eligibility, not the adoptive family's eligibility. Where it gets different with relatives is that if the relative has been fostering the child and we are not paying that relative a foster care rate, we are paying them non-needy relative assistance. The relative can still get adoption assistance if they adopt the child, and it's actually at a higher rate than they've received for fostering the child.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll bring it to you offline.
Okay.
I'll do my own investigation report that.
It's fine. And Kathy, have you taken a look at House Bill 2387? This is the one that gives preference to prospective parents, adoptive parents living in this state versus outside of the state.
Chair Dalto, yes, I have.
Yeah, Representative Nelson, I invited her to come down. I don't know if she's here, so we'll just take a little bit of time with this. But your thoughts?
Okay. I have prepared some testimony. This is not official agency testimony. It hasn't gone through all the levels of approval, but I will briefly comment. We would oppose this bill for a couple of reasons. First of all, it does have a fiscal impact on the agency, so it has a price tag that would cause it to be cost prohibitive for us at this time. The policy reasons that we would oppose this bill are, first of all, it's contrary to good social work. The Child Welfare League of America publishes periodically. The last publication was in the year 2000. Child Welfare League of America is the most prestigious and well-known, most widely respected child welfare organization and sets standards for child welfare practice in many areas. They set the standard. We agree with that. The federal government agrees with it, that all adoption planning should be based on the needs of the child, not the needs of the family, the needs of the child. And as in actual practice, I already commented that about a third of our adoptions are with relatives. Relatives are not always not only the most suitable adoptive resource, but many of the relatives in the multi-generational families that we sometimes come into contact with are not always safe people for the children to even have continuing contact with. So each case is individualized. We do make attempts to involve relatives in the planning, adoptive planning. The child's pre-existing relationship and ties with biological family is something we always take into consideration. Consideration, but it's not always the only consideration. And sometimes the most suitable adoptive resource for a child is located in another state. When that happens, we do make very concerted efforts to keep the child in touch with especially grandparents and siblings and other parts of the family that it's safe for the child to have contact with. The biggest reason that we would oppose this bill is that it's contrary to federal law. Federal law, the Adoption and Safe Families Act of 1997, which was brought into our state statute in 1999, states that it is illegal to deny or delay the adoptive placement of a child based on the geographic location of the child or the approved adoptive family. So we would be violating federal law at the present time if we were to adopt this legislation as written.
Okay, so we can't afford it. It's contrary to good social work, and the feds don't like it anyway. Okay, well, that's why we're having this hearing. Where does the price tag come out of curiosity? Could you explain that?
Sure. Chair Dalto, it comes from a very conservative estimate. In a two-year period, we placed 241 children adoptively out of state. Very conservative, we would estimate that that would prolong the time in foster care for each of those children by 1 month. While we stopped the clocks, only considered the in-state family, all the in-state families before considering out-of-state families. It's a very conservative estimate, and it's $141,000 for the biennium.
It seems to me that a lot of these particular bills that we consider and a lot of issues that come up, and every time a legislator calls your office, calls the Department of Human Services to bring them in to talk about, you know, an adoption that they perceive has just been botched, that a lot of that is coming from sort of anecdotes, individual stories about people who are unhappy with outcomes. And maybe there's some kind of way that we can help those families to understand why those outcomes are the way they are, and what steps have been taken. And the reason why, you know, I'm interested in this document on the safe plan meetings and all that kind of stuff, is it gives something specific for people to understand. They may not like the outcome, but at least they know, you know, all the steps that are put into place and the options available to them, so people can at least have some kind of choice or have some kind of information. So do we have that sort of tool available to us in these adoption proceedings, so that the families or the neighbors or, you know, the person they met at the supermarket line who got incensed at this understands, you know, what the procedure was that was followed, so they can follow along themselves. You understand what I'm saying? The more information, I think the more information that we have available to those folks within reason, the better they will understand what's happening, and maybe we can reduce the number of sort of contested placements or people that feel bad about the situation. What do you think?
Chair Dalton, members of the committee, I really appreciate your question and your intent. It's very difficult often for families to understand why they're not selected to adopt a child or to parent a child. The reason that we created, and we call the letter in-house, brutally honest letter to relatives, is the relative rule-out letter. The reason that we even created that was because out of the 1997 legislative session, when we were going through something similar to this, where families just weren't understanding the reasons that we couldn't accept them. What we've then done is, if a family comes to you and says, I just don't get it, I don't get why I wasn't accepted, we ask you to obtain a release of information from the family and share that information with you. And we can share freely, if upon their agreement, that information that pertains to them. What we couldn't share at that point is information about other family members or the child.
Okay. Let's let's take this off track for just a moment. There's another bill that we didn't put up on the agenda because there still needs to be some work done to refine that. But that bill had to do with giving the legislature and legislators authority to go into child welfare cases and collect information and documents for their independent review. And I know that you know that bill. You're tracking that bill as well. And I think it might be appropriate to say a few words about how that might work. And I'll let Mickey decide who wants to talk about that. But before we move on to that, I think that, as my good colleague from Northwest Portland pointed out, some kind of child welfare policy statement to the public saying, this is what we're doing, this is how we do it, these are the options. These questions that I'm asking probably would respond well to some kind of statement like that that we may not have already. So we'll wind up asking the department to do some more work on that as we continue to work through. So thank you very much.
It also might be useful if you can guess. What was the organization you mentioned that does social welfare policy?
Chair Dalto, Representative Greenlee, it's the Child Welfare League of America, CWLA.
Do they have a set of policy statements you might look at as well?
Absolutely. It's called Excellence in Adoption. It's part of a series of child welfare practice.
We also have one on Child Protective Services. Mm-hmm. I mean, it might be useful if you see some of those background documents and information.
Karina could probably put that together for us. Right. Yeah. Representative Farr, did you have anything? We're just sort of firing away here.
No, I don't think so.
Okay, thanks very much. Okay, thank you, Kathy.
Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah, we're going to talk about that other bill.
Chair Dalto, members of the committee, again, Mickey Cerise with the Department of Human Services. I believe that, I don't remember the bill number offhand, but I think the bill basically stated that the legislature could access records from state agencies when they had concerns or they wanted to review those records.
And let's limit the framework of this discussion to adoptions and child welfare incidents.
Okay. There were, in the area of child welfare, we checked with legal counsel to see what type of barriers we would have if we were to incorporate that law as it was written, and there were a number of challenges both at the state and the federal level. What I recall from the very quick and brief analysis were challenges to the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act, which is a federal funding source for our state. Also Title IV-E, which is the primary funding source for our foster care program or child welfare program. And I believe there were a couple of other challenges with simply opening up records where at the national level we're required to maintain privacy and confidentiality for children who have been abused and neglected and, of course, families who are involved with those children. And that's just in the child welfare arena. It seemed like there were unintended consequences for a number of other state agencies the way the bill was written.
Well, how do you get at then, or how should we sort of approach the interest by members of this assembly to... And I hesitate to sort of suggest that they should act as referees because it's not really what they're trying to accomplish. But in order to effectively advocate for their constituents when they feel like the constituent has an issue that's being improperly resolved, and I just sort of thinking through that as we go along here. I mean, the legislator doesn't even have the complete information. I mean, we just heard from an individual, a family from down south. We don't have the complete information. We sort of take what they tell us, and you know, without sort of going into detail on that one, you know, legislator doesn't have the information. So some, a family could come in, a constituent could come in, and you want to provide good service to that constituent, and it sounds from everything that they are telling the legislator, boy, that kind of makes sense, or maybe the department could have done a better job here, or maybe there's some other things. But you don't get all that information, and how are we responsive to our colleagues in the assembly that want to be able to do that kind of level? I mean, in my experience, in two terms here, and one is a legislative item. And those are very difficult cases to sort of get into. Mickey, you and I have talked on the phone extensively about a couple of them, but I don't want to do the casework on child welfare issues. I want to do public policy. And what are your thoughts?
Well, Chair Dalto, and members of the committee, that's an excellent question, and I think that. If we can figure out a public policy that would allow that to occur, I think that we would go a long way to resolving a lot of the questions that people have. Offhand, I would say the simple answer is if we can get a signed release from the constituent that's calling you, we might be able to answer almost all the questions, maybe not all of them. As Kathy mentioned, we have unique family situations in child welfare. So if we have a separated family issue, for instance, and your constituent is signing a release of information, we can release part of the record, maybe not all of the record. The child welfare system is a convergence with not only the social service system, but also with law enforcement and the juvenile court, or the judicial branch of government. So when we have a constituent that's calling a legislature, we actually have all three branches of government coming to a loggerhead. We have the legislative, judicial, and the executive branches of government. And what we're trying to do is figure out a way, if I'm understanding your question correctly, how do we make that information available to the legislative branch of government when, in fact, those records are, by statute, both in Oregon and in federal law, being maintained and guarded by the judicial branch of government and also the executive branch of government. Not all of the records that we would have in what we would call a record or a folder would be considered a child welfare or DHS record. Some of those documents in there would also be considered court documents.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think when we get to this, what you're raising but you haven't said is that I think there may be a significant separation of powers issue involved in this. I think there may be a constitutional issue, and it's one that I'll be raising and asking our counsel to look at. I'm not sure constituent service is really a formal function of the legislature, in a sense, and that's going to be an interesting question. I imagine we have the power to subpoena records under certain circumstances when it's required for us to do our job, and I think it's going to be, I think there's going to be a very fine constitutional issue here, and I sense that's what you were raising by talking about the
Chair Dalto and Representative Greenlit. Thank you for articulating that for me. I do think a policy direction that you would hear from the Department of Human Services is that we want to be as open as possible with the records that we do have, as long as we can stay within the state and federal laws that govern those particular records, and we have. At times, we have taken legal advice and have asked them to allow us some flexibilities in certain situations to provide information. So we do try to do that in an open way, yet on the other side of the fence, I'm sure it doesn't feel that way always. So
He tells me if I need somebody to be helpful, you're the one to talk to. So you've obviously done a good job.
Sorry to add to your workload.
No, that's fine. That's what I'm here for.
Okay. Mickey, here's what I'd like you to do, if you'd be willing. I would like the department to come back Thursday, which is our next meeting, with some suggestions for a policy statement that sort of regularizes, formalizes the process for legislators to gain access to that information within the parameters that we have within existing law, but some kind of policy so that everybody's clear about what they are able to do and maybe what they're not able to do within the counsel that you've received from the Department of Justice. But let's start with that as a starting point.
Okay.
Can you do that by Thursday?
Yes,
okay.
Can.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much. We'll still continue on. We'll continue on House Bill 2009, and then we'll come back to 2387. And there are some folks from Adoption Services that will come up after that. So I'll bring up Cindy Finch. Cindy Finch here. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Cindy Finch, and I am for the House Bill 2009. And I apologize for handwritten. I just heard about this bill this morning, and I jumped on a bus to get here, and I wrote it on the bus.
Well, we're glad you're here, so that's not a problem.
It's noble.
I'm just going to give you a brief. I feel fortunate to listen to DHS come here and talk. But I'm glad that I got to hear some of the things they had to say, because she discussed with you the bond that they create in foster care, and that was kind of a little frustrating to me, because I have three children in permanent foster care, one is which been awarded to my sister. All three of them were approved in the interstate compact. She's a licensed foster parent. They're separating my children. They're sending one daughter back to my sister and keeping two here because they said that this bond has been created with a foster parent. But my question is what bond's stronger? 14 years of siblings or a 6-month relationship with cult in a foster home? So I'm just kind of, I just wanted to bring that to the plate. And
where's your sister living?
She lives in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
Also, my sister has been a part of this case. I've been in dealing with DHS for two years now. My fault. I explained I had an addiction. I allowed my husband to grow marijuana. I slipped into my addiction when my kids were taken away from me 9 months later. My sister agreed with told DHS she'd be willing to even move out here if she had some kind of agreement that the kids could be placed with her. DHS said no. You know, they're bonded to this foster parent that they've been with for 6 months or whatever. And I just feel that's frustration. That's frustrated for me because, I'm sorry, I'm really nervous. Can you tell?
No, it's okay. You're doing fine.
The foster parent that my kids are with, they're 62 years old. One of them's been in and out of the hospital with heart attack, feeding tube, can't hear. They're not providing the care like I think they should. You know, they're not allowed to be in physical sports, things like that. And there's no physical affection. My phone calls with my children, all I hear in the background is the foster parent yelling to end the phone conversation as soon as they're told that they tell me that they love me or things like that. It's just been very frustrating for me.
Very hard, I understand.
Yeah, and so I'm hoping that this bill will be passed so that, you know, I just think, for one, there's a lot of kids in foster care that I just think that, okay, I don't know how to word this right, but when it's family providing care for these children, they meet their needs a lot more. Like my sister, I know, would never yell at my kids or force them to say mean things to me like the foster parent does now. So I feel like that there's a bond between family members that aren't between foster parents, and that's all I have to say. I'm sorry.
It's okay. It's all right. Can I ask you a question, or how are you doing in your recovery? Are you moving on?
Oh yeah, I have a 2-month-old daughter. I've graduated from treatment. I'm currently in outpatient. I work with. I'm trying to become part of a mentor program that kind of bamboozles people to get in treatment. So I'm going for that. I'm also. I start school in June.
Persuade, I think, is a good
one. Whatever. I start school in June to become a drug counselor. So
good for you.
Yeah. Thanks.
Well, we wish you every success.
Can I ask
keep
myself?
Sure.
I want to make sure I understand what your point is here. Are you saying that you would prefer to have your children in placement across a state line with your sister?
Absolutely.
Than with a non-relative parent?
Absolutely.
Here. So you're opposed to a restriction that would necessarily keep them.
Absolutely.
In state. Thank you.
Is that it?
Yes. Can I ask you one more question?
Yes.
Is there a plan to reunite your children in your home?
No. I'm just going to be honest with you. The DHS worker that I worked with said I was a lost cause. And that's too bad because I'm not.
Did you sign over your parental rights? Okay. Well, nobody's a lost cause, so you show them that they're wrong.
Thanks.
Okay. We're on 2009. Robin Pope, please.
Thank you, Chair Dalto. I'd actually like to know if we could also bring up two other people who are here to testify, and they are signed up. It would be Susan Cox from Holt,
right.
Ellie Harrell from BGAS.
Right, but is that on 2009?
Oh, I don't know if they signed up on 2009. Oh, they did not.
Okay, yes. I'll bring them up on 2009.
Okay.
Thanks. I mean, excuse me, on the bill that they're signed up.
On 2387,
sure,
I think we all have sort of a common
right.
cause there.
Okay. Can you introduce yourself again for the record, please?
Sure, thank you. My name is Robin Pope. I'm an attorney. I limit my practice to adoption and related matters, Chair Dalto and members of the committee. I am a member of the Oregon State Bar Standing Committee on Adoption and the prior chair of that committee, and I'm a member of the American Academy of Adoption Attorneys. I work throughout the state of Oregon and also with people from around the country on adoption matters. I'm here first on House Bill 2009, and I just want to say, after listening to the young woman who just testified, that I'm not sure if there's any procedure in place at this point in terms of keeping siblings together, but that certainly seemed to be something she cared a lot about, was keeping her children together, having a preference for that. My position and the position of some of my colleagues is that we believe what is addressed by House Bill 2009 is already covered by policy, administrative rule that is used and enforced by DHS, that we need to be ultimately and mostly concerned with the best interests of the child, and that is not always with placing with relatives, although sometimes it can be. And certainly, I think the state of Oregon has been trying to do that more and more, and they have done that through their policy. We do have open adoption agreements that are legal and enforceable agreements in the state of Oregon that allow for ongoing contact between birth relatives and a child who has been adopted. So it's not just a birth parent, but also a birth relative. I believe that amendment was made to that statute last session. And we just, it truly does boil down to the best interests of the child that we need to make those decisions. There are also times when birth parents, whether they're working with the state or with someone else, they participate in the choice of where their child is placed. And I know that the state is doing that more so that instead of having an involuntary termination of parental rights, there may be mediation and working with DHS to have a voluntary termination. But as part of that, there is work together to find an appropriate placement for the child. And a lot of times, birth parents don't want their children going to their relatives.
I'm sorry, just to clarify that,
sure.
You're saying that there are circumstances where the birth parents do participate because they're suggesting some relatives to contact?
Well, they may suggest relatives, but in some cases they suggest non-relatives.
Okay.
They don't want their child going to a relative. I remember I had a birth mother once who was working with an agency. She was an Indian, and she didn't want her child going to her tribe because she didn't want her child growing up the way she had been raised. I have encountered other birth parents who've grown up in abused or neglected homes, and they don't want their children going back into that cycle that they believe is part of their family cycle. They want to break that cycle. And I think that the state is willing to work with birth parents, and we shouldn't prohibit them from doing that.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much. And we'll bring you right back, Robin.
Okay.
And Julie McFarlane. Here's what we're going to do. In terms of people that are signed up, there's a panel of 1, 2, 3, 4 on 2387, and it looks like Robin's on that panel, two adoption agency folks, and Julie, you're on that panel as well. So let's just finish the testimony on this one, and then we'll invite that whole panel to come up together next, and then I'll ask another question of the department, and hopefully we'll get out of here in just a few minutes. So welcome back. Introduce yourself again, please.
Yes. Chair Dalto, members of the committee, my name is Julie McFarlane. I'm a supervising attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project. I'm submitting written testimony on House Bill 2009, which we oppose. And I think that you have already heard testimony that there is already placement preferences both in the juvenile court statute, and I've attached a copy of that, 419B192, which requires that a preference be given to placement with relatives and persons who have a child-parent relationship with the child. And in the Oregon Administrative Rules, which Ms. Ledesma talked about, and which are extensive and are also attached to my testimony, I think the issue is well covered by the rules. We need to be able to first consider the best interests of the child. We need to be able to consider that children may have been stable in non-relative placements. We need to be able to make individualized decisions. And I think, as you can see from the interesting contrast of these two bills, is that these are Solomon-like decisions. And people can be unhappy that children are placed with relatives, which means that they're going out of state and leaving foster homes where they are attached to the children, and vice versa when the decision has been made that the attachment is to the foster home. People can be unhappy that the children are not going to relatives. So they're difficult decisions. There's good policy already, and we don't need this statute.
Julie, the Juvenile Rights Project advocates for the rights of children. What about the issue that came up about keeping siblings together and some kind of preference? And I don't know, I'm not sure if the department explained it. I have a limited capacity to take in information, but do we have a preference right now to keep siblings together?
Chair Delta, we do not have, and that's actually a trend in national legislation to establish, they're like called sibling bills of rights.
Do you think that's appropriate?
It's an issue that we have looked at sponsoring legislation on, and because of the difficult, you know, sometimes you have kids who really it is better for them to be split up. Sometimes you have kids who really should be staying together. We weren't unable to come up with a very good proposal. I think it would be an excellent issue to study. And I think there would be a lot of people who have very strong feelings about the sibling split issue.
This national movement, is there a group that's discussing that on a national level?
Chair Dalton, what I'm most familiar with is, I believe it's called AB 436, which is the California legislation, and so California has kind of led the way on this, and there's a law professor in California who has written law review articles and gone around the country talking about it. He was here in Oregon.
What is that again, the AB?
I believe it's AB, I think Assembly Bill 436.
And there was an individual expert, who was that?
It's a professor, I believe, from McGeorge Law School, and he wrote law review articles. I'd be happy to supply that information if you.
Yeah, I would. That'd be great. If we can get Karina to connect with you. Okay. Anything else? Okay. Thanks. And you can stay right there, and we'll move now to House Bill 2387, and invite Susan Cox, Kelly Harold, and Robin Pope forward, and. If you can just pull up one more chair and. Okay. All right.
Whoops.
Get it out. Is that the coalition? Okay, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Dalto. I think you know everyone who's here. We have Julie McFarland. I'm Robin Pope.
Susan Cox.
And Kelly Harrell.
Okay. All right, I'll let you decide who's going to start.
Do you want to go? Okay. I guess I'll go ahead and go. Okay. I've already introduced myself previously, and I have some written testimony that I'm submitting for the record. My bar committee has discussed this bill, and I'm not sure we have unanimous opinion, but we are close to that in terms of opposing it. However, I'm speaking here for myself today.
I'm concerned in part about the constitutionality of this bill if it's passed. It would deny a birth parent who places their child for adoption the right to choose where that child goes and with whom by saying you have to give preference to an Oregon family. There are a lot of birth parents, for whatever reason, decide to place their child outside the state of Oregon. And I don't believe that we, the state of Oregon, and this legislature, should prohibit that person from making that choice. That's the ultimate decision that a parent makes about a child, is where they are going to grow up.
What sort of reasons would a parent want the child placed in another state, based on your experience?
Sometimes it's the type of lifestyle that they want their child to experience. I had a client, a family once, who lived in another state, and they were selected by the birth parent because they lived a more rural lifestyle. It was very different from anything they could find here, and they identified with that. It's interesting because we also have birth parents from outside the state of Oregon who choose Oregon families. And my guess is that if we were to pass this bill and other states learned of it, they go, well, you don't want your babies going out of state. Maybe we'll have to do this, and we don't want our babies going to Oregon. And you could create, I think, some difficulties throughout the country. It would be perceived as a discriminatory bill. I think, again, we're back to the best interests of children, and we really need to be looking at that. I used to represent children in custody cases back when I did a lot of family law, and it's very important that we focus on the child and not just the grown-ups here, and the preference that, you know, maybe we want children to stay here in Oregon, but the birth parent gets to make that decision about their child. I'm trying to think of some other reasons. Sometimes it's a nationality thing. They may want their child raised by a particular family with certain characteristics, be it religious or cultural, and they're not able to find a family here. That can happen. Sometimes I've had birth parents who've chosen families from outside the country, even, not just outside the state. And that's a choice that they've made. We're concerned. I know that Tim Brewer is an attorney in Eugene who does a lot of international adoption work, and he's concerned about how this bill would apply to inter-country adoptions. And that is a concern because more and more Oregonians are adopting children from other countries. And there are three ways that that happens. One is that they actually complete the adoption in the other country. When they return here to Oregon, they often re-adopt the child under Oregon law. We're not sure as to how it would impact that process. In some situations, such as Korea and India, when the children come back over here with their adoptive parents, the adoption has not been completed in the other country. And so it has to be completed here in Oregon. And again, we're not clear as to what problems that could create with the other country and the process of placing children with Oregon families in these other countries. And then sometimes there's a disrupted adoption when a child has been adopted in another country, brought here, and then for whatever reasons, typically attachment disorder, but the placement disrupts, and then there is a subsequent placement or replacement. And I'll be honest with you, I've had clients who have gone through that process, and they have not been able to find families in Oregon to take those children, but they have been able to find families in other states. And I would not want to set restrictions that would prohibit that from happening. Again, you could end up with a fiscal impact to the state if these children get put into foster care.
Okay. Can you clarify something for me?
Sure.
The sort of, I don't know if the word is fluidity, but the ease of which we're able to move kids across state lines into other states. I mean, you have some kind of network. You obviously know who to call to find an adoptive placement in another state.
That sometimes happens through agencies. Some of our Oregon agencies are licensed in more than one state, and so a lot of the agency, private agency placements that occur could happen. For example, New Hope has offices both in Washington and Oregon, and frequently I'll end up representing an adoptive family from Washington who comes down here to adopt an Oregon child because the birth mother's chosen them. So it happens through an agency network. It happens through an individual agency. It can happen through attorneys. In Oregon, it's against the law to use facilitators, so I'm hoping it's not happening through the use of facilitators. A group of us have worked very hard to try to prohibit facilitation in adoptions in the state of Oregon.
There's money.
There's a lot of money that passes hands, particularly these days over the Internet, to simply facilitate hooking up a birth parent with a set of adoptive parents somewhere in the country. And in Oregon, we consider that against the law, and we've worked hard to try to prevent that from happening.
Okay.
So I don't see that happening. It does happen some, but not with the reputable agencies and the reputable attorneys.
Okay. Thanks, Representative Farr.
Thank you, Chair Dalto. I just have a question because I've been reading through the bill and listening to your testimony, and the bill just states that it would give preference to prospective adoptive parents who live in the state.
Correct.
Over those who live outside the state. And it provides exceptions that are clearly outlined in the bill. So...
Thank you. My name is Susan Cox, and I'm Vice President of Policy and External Affairs for Holt International Children's Services in Eugene, Oregon. And what you've been hearing about from Robin is infant adoption. And there's a whole different category of adoptions, children from foster care, and then also international adoptions. And while it certainly does make provision for that, with relationship to children in foster care, there is, as Kathy Ledesma was talking about, there is the whole the ASFA, where you cannot deny or delay the adoption of a child. One of the things, Chair Dalto, you were talking about the explanation for a family that isn't selected, and there is an organization. It's called the Adopt U.S. Kids, and it is a collaboration funded by the federal government through Health and Human Services. It's the largest single-funded project trying to get children and eliminate barriers for children in adoption. And one of the emerging ways to find families for children in foster care is through the Internet. And so there are posted children, their profiles, they're not identified, but children all over the country. And so families are finding children for adoption without the limitations of geography and boundaries. And so that really has been an incredibly positive step forward in placing children for adoption. And so this in particular would be a problem for those children. The reciprocity would certainly be an issue. If you were an Oregon family and you wanted to adopt a child and they were, for example, in Montana, then Montana families could say, well, wait a minute, we're going to give preference to our families. And, you know, adoption really is about finding families for children, not children for families, and the very best family possible. And one of the things that the Adopt U.S. Kids website explains a little bit is that people come into the process at different times. And so there may be an Oregon family that sees a child, a particular child wants to adopt them, but they're just beginning the process, and it's going to take months and months before it's all completed. Meanwhile, there's a family in another state that's ready now. So it's a complicated system, and just on the surface of it, you think, well, my goodness, why wouldn't an Oregon family be given priority and preference? But the problem is, where does that go in terms of delay and deny? Also, this is one of those cases where it doesn't really specify whether or not this is for only domestic adoption. And we forget that there are literally 20,000 children a year adopted into the United States internationally, and certainly a lot of those children come to the U.S. And Holt places about 1,000 children a year, and they are through a network of cooperating agencies, and we're licensed in every state. We couldn't possibly begin to say, well, we're lining up all the Oregon families first. And it wouldn't be practical. So we oppose this bill for the same reasons that have been addressed previously, but in particular think that it's not the geographic boundaries between children and states is, in practice, not a good one. And the more we can eliminate those boundaries and not think of these as Oregon's children and Washington's children or their children and our children, but the children, it really is going to be in the best interest, and we will place more children for adoption.
I wasn't tracking on your example about limiting the geography to Oregon on international placements coming in. I mean, I don't think that's what this bill is talking about.
But it doesn't specify that. It doesn't say specifically that this would be, it talks about adoption agencies. And I think the intent certainly is for domestic adoption, but it doesn't eliminate the possibility that it would include international adoption. Because we are licensed to place children. And
so what you're saying is that House Bill, you're trying to suggest that House Bill 2387 would have an effect on Holt's adoptions in other states?
It's a possibility. Right. We don't think it clearly says that it would only
affect. I can't imagine
affect.
How that would be possible.
It may not be the intent of the bill, Chair Dalto and members, but it's certainly because of the ambiguity and the failure to specifically exempt out specific types of adoptions, it's left open for, I think, lots of interpretation that could end up creating obstacles we didn't mean to create.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Thank you very much. And then Kelly.
Sorry, what was your name? Kelly Harold.
Kelly Harold.
Yeah. Good afternoon, Chair Dalto. I'm Kelly Harold from Boys and Girls Aid Society. The other comment that they've mostly made all my, given all my information, so I'll keep it brief, but one thing that is not addressed here is independent adoptions for newborns that are done through attorneys. So we'd really have a different set of standards for newborns that are adopted through agencies, and about half of the newborns or more are adopted through attorneys. So that's another issue with this bill, is that it would really fracture practice. It's when attorneys do infant placements, they wouldn't come under the same set of rules, because this is really about child placing agencies.
Okay.
So I just want to make that comment.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Julie. Short, right?
Very brief, Chair Belto. Thank you. For the record, Julie McFarland from Juvenile Rights Project, and we have submitted written testimony in opposition to House Bill 2387. Our concerns have already been talked about. I agree with the testimony from the agency in terms of this bill would be a violation of the Adoption and Safe Families Act, given that federal law preempts. I think that this bill would be totally without legs if it was passed. The reason it would conflict with ASFA is that ASFA has a lot of emphasis on eliminating delay in achieving permanency for children in foster care. This was identified as a delay problem, that adoptive families were being rejected for a number of different reasons, because they weren't the right race, because they were in the wrong state, all of those things. It was determined by Congress when they studied these issues were to the detriment of children, and that we needed to have access to the most suitable family for the individual child, and to do that as expeditiously as possible. And if I could just ask your indulgence for one further comment on another issue that was raised, the issue of preparing a brochure for parents involved in juvenile court cases. That issue has arisen previously, I think, in the full committee, and I do have some concerns about whether that can be done in a way that provides enough information to parents on the really serious issues involved in juvenile court cases. And I think it would be a mistake and an injustice to parents to treat the matter too lightly. And a trifold just could not begin to answer all the questions that parents get faced with when they begin to be involved in these juvenile court cases. I am familiar with, and I provided a copy, and I think the agency is familiar with as well, a national publication for parents. I think it's about 60 pages long. It's available on the web. It could be something that could be linked to by the agency, but I think we need to be really cautious that we don't deceive ourselves, that we can give parents enough information in a brochure to answer all those questions.
You understand that I'm not suggesting that the agency needs to provide information to tell parents how to defend themselves or get into their case in depth. It's basically, look, here are the steps, here's what you can expect, and by the way, you know, maybe you want to go out and get some help, that kind of thing. So, okay, thanks to each one of you.
Thank you.
Keep lawyers busy, right? Okay, it looks like I had an individual sign up for the public comment. I'd like to hear for a few moments from that individual, and then I have a question to the Department of Human Services, and then we'll have to adjourn promptly at 6. So was there anybody that wanted to offer public comment that didn't have a chance to sign up? No? Okay. Is Jim Long still here? Jim Long? No Jim Long. Okay, well, we'll invite the department up then, and if Mr. Long reappears, we'll invite him down. Thanks, Ramona, for coming back.
Sure.
I had a question. I had a question about Washington's new efforts under their Kids Come First reforms, and one of them in particular that stood out to me was the requirement that the Child Protection Agency and its workers conduct a face-to-face visit within 24 hours of a high-risk report of child abuse or neglect, and that children with a lower risk would have a face-to-face contact within 72 hours, and that follow-up visits would be phased in and required within 30 days for children receiving in-home services. So what are your thoughts? What are we doing along those lines?
Chair Dalto, I appreciate the opportunity to respond to that. I've been
Can you
following.
Check in with your name again?
Oh, I'm sorry. That's Ramona fine. Foley, Assistant Director, Department of Human Services, Children, Adults, and Families. I've been following the news about Washington State, but also have been interested, as we are always interested in how things are happening in other states. What can we learn from that? They had, as you know, a face-to-face contact on child protective service cases where there's immediate danger. Their policy had been up to 10 days. And I'm aware that in January they had a child who died on day number 9. And the policy had been that policy, I guess, for a number of years. When I arrived in Oregon, our policy wasn't dissimilar. We had about a 7-day limit on when we had to make that face-to-face contact. And so a couple of years ago, we issued a new rule. The guided assessment process, which you hear referred to as GAP, requires face-to-face contact within the 24 hours if there's immediate danger. And then while Washington is proposing to go to 72 hours, if there's not immediate danger, our current policy allows 5 days if there's not immediate danger, and that 5 days is dependent on the child, the perpetrator, alleged perpetrator, not having access to the child. So in other words, if a call came in and there was an allegation of abuse, but the individual perhaps who was making the report said, I think this happened 2 months ago, but the mom's boyfriend now has been in jail and is going to be in jail for 6 months, that might get a 5-day response. The other issue that you mentioned is Washington is going to say that visits have to occur within 30 days on an in-home service case. Again, our policy used to be in foster care. We had to see a child every 90 days if the child was in state custody. We changed that policy, and now in both in-home service cases as well as in foster care cases, the policy requires face-to-face contact every 30 days. I would caution that the easiest task is to change the policy. The harder task is the implementation and the ongoing management and monitoring of that. And so while I commend Washington for taking the steps to move forward to revise the policy, I also wish them luck, as I do myself every day, that we have good luck in also trying to control caseload size and make sure that we're following all the policies we have in place.
So what you're saying is we're actually ahead of Washington in some ways.
In some ways, at least in these couple of examples.
In policy, that's it. Practice is another issue. You had to go and bring up reality, Representative Greenlee. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. What about the issue that they had about criminal background checks?
I was, Chair Dalto, I was unsure because I have not heard any discussion around what that's about. It looked like, just from the news release, that maybe there was a concern that certain individuals with some criminal backgrounds were coming into employ where they would have access to children. But
is
I'd
that
have
possible
to,
here?
I'd have to search a little further, because we do criminal background checks for employees coming in to the agency, as we do other state agencies like OIA. But I am unsure exactly what they were using as a qualifier to say the person could or could not work in the area of child welfare.
Okay, but what is our practice for child welfare workers?
Our child welfare workers, if there has been a criminal, been a conviction related to something like child abuse, related to other kinds of crimes, of one-on-one personal crimes against individuals, that individuals, my understanding, would not be acceptable into the workforce.
Okay. I just got my renewal notice for my background check for volunteering at Family Building Blocks.
Well, Charbelto, congratulations.
So how about that?
Get your fingerprints in there.
I'm free and clear.
Good.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, go ahead.
Can I ask a question?
Anything you want.
Something else. Can we get a copy of that gap assessment?
I have
it. Oh, you do have it. Would you share it? That would be great. Thank you. And I did read in the paper also that OYA has just done some stuff to protect children. Maybe somewhere along the line we ought to hear from what they've done on that.
We just got a report. I mean, I got some materials in my office from Mr. Jester, the director of OYA, in particular response to that. So,
there was a newspaper story today on one of the things they were doing.
Chair Dalton and Representative Greenlee, one thing I would offer to, because in I guess full faith reporting here, when Oregon went to the position of having the criminal records checks done on employees, it's my understanding that there was not a budget that would allow that to be done across the thousands of employees that were currently working. And I think what has happened over the years is now it is done on all new employees, and it's also done as employees change jobs within the department, such as going to another job, promotion or whatever. But I wouldn't want you to think that every single individual working in the agency has had that criminal records check, because it was, people were grandfathered in, more or less.
Every single person in the child welfare agency?
If they were already, my understanding, Chair Dalto, is if they were already employed and they have not changed positions, they have not necessarily had that criminal records check.
So there are some long-term employees in child welfare that may not have had that background.
Chair Dalto, that is true. If there's any reason to suspect there is a criminal background, then the management could have asked for that.
Okay. All right. Anything else? Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Anybody else wishing to come forward? Okay. Well, with that, thanks to everybody for being here today, and we will adjourn this meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Oh, very good.